on rules. It is July 14th. We're having an informational hearing on the Governor's Education Investment Plan. Mr. Sager, Senator Gordley, do you want to come forward?
There's a list now.
Okay. Good morning. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm James Sager from the Governor's Office, and with the Senator sitting next to me, I feel like I should allow her to speak first, but
I will defer to Mr. Sager.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Well, I think I was a little delayed because I was trying to get a bill ready for your committee at 2 o'clock, so you know where I'm going to be.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Brown. Again, James Sager from the Governor's Office, and what I would like to do is take some time to give you some background on the thinking of the Governor, his rationale for pulling this idea together, walk you through the highlights of the plan, and then, by all means, Senator Gordley can join me in comments, and we'll open it up to questions. You have in front of you, I believe, a document that we prepared that give you some the highlights of the proposal, and so I'll get to that in a minute, and you can follow through the plan. The governor believes very strongly that we need to grow our economy. It's that fundamental. We need to put Oregonians back to work in family wage jobs. Business leaders that the governor speaks to, in fact, he is with a group of them right now that are looking at coming to Oregon, don't ask him about our tax structure or the governmental regulations. Their question is, what's your commitment to education? What's your commitment to providing us not only a ready workforce that we can start with, but an ongoing, well-educated, well-trained workforce so that we can grow our businesses? That is true for businesses here in Oregon that are looking to expand. He hears that across the state. The number one issue that they're looking for is a well-educated and a well-trained workforce. Growing the economy and putting Oregonians back to work will help reduce the crime rate. We know that. We'll have a reduced need for jail beds. If we allow Oregonians to take care of themselves and their families, we actually help reduce the need for the social support systems that we have in this state. And the state revenue will actually improve, and so that we have the revenue necessary to pay for the programs that we wish to have. And so he really sees this, that education is the economic driver that is going to provide the economy that we want for the future and support the way of life that we want here in this state. The Oregon Education Enterprise Plan then is really an investment in children and adults and an investment in the future of our way of life. It is a floor. I want to make that clear. The governor sees this, and we have written the language to make it clear that it is a floor for the education enterprise, not a cap. We still need to deal with issues like tax equity and whether or not we have adequate funding to pay for all of the programs, both educational and others, that we need, the revenue streams, but that's a separate piece. He wanted to focus on making sure that we had a good, solid floor under our education programs. And so to the plan directly, I've used the word education enterprise several times, and over here we have a chart, and it's on the document in front of you. The governor is concerned that historically we have talked about education in this bifurcated manner, where we have K-12 and the community colleges and OUS system and others coming in, and they're all fighting over dollars. And it's time that we look at this as an education enterprise. The entire system must be supported. We could choose to have the very best K-12 education program in the country, and if we have a second-rate post-secondary system, if we don't have a good solid workforce development system, then we get nowhere. And vice versa. If we don't have a top-rated K-12 system, we don't have the supply line to get into our post-secondary education program. So the governor looked at the elements of the budget and identified the seven pieces that he feels are necessary for the enterprise. We must have Oregon Pre-K Head Start included in the enterprise. So that's number one. We have to start even earlier than we do in the K-12 level, and we need to make the commitment to that floor and that growth pattern for Pre-K Head Start. Of course, the K-12 program, our community colleges and workforce department, the Oregon University System, OHSU, and specifically the schools of dentistry, medicine, and nursing, OSAC, which is the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, which is where the opportunity grants and the support for students exist, and then the Oregon Department of Education. So those are the elements of the enterprise. He looked at this from the standpoint of providing, as we have up there, stability, predictability, and an investment. He wants to dedicate 61% of the general fund to the education enterprise. He chooses the general fund as opposed to the personal income tax for a very clear reason. We have a shared responsibility for educating our youth and our adults in this state. It isn't just the individual that is responsible for this. By utilizing the general fund, we include both personal and corporate income tax, and thus we have that, we maintain that shared responsibility model. And the other element of that, if you think about it, while as individuals we benefit by having greater education as an individual, our society benefits by having better educated citizenry, but the single biggest beneficiary of a well-educated, well-trained workforce is the business community. That's what's going to allow them to expand and prosper and be competitive. And so it's important that they have a stake, a shared responsibility in this commitment. So he is looking at 61% of the general fund as opposed to the personal income tax. The governor also has calculated that we need to have at least a 10% growth factor built in. And again, what we did is approach it from the standpoint of looking at what is the highest level of guarantee that we can provide in the system so that, in fact, we end the disinvestment that has taken place throughout the enterprise over the past several years, and we begin to rebuild. Again, this is not a plan for adequacy, as some of us may define it. It is a plan to make sure that we get a good, solid floor and we can begin the reinvestment. So we've used the 10% factor because that is what it requires in order to maintain that floor, provide that predictability in the system. And because the economists have predicted that the general fund will grow throughout the rest of this decade at about a 12% rate, it allows us to dedicate 10% in this manner and then take the additional growth above the 10% and to put it into two reserve accounts similar to the way the speaker's plan does. Again, just a slight difference in the way these take place. Because we're talking about the education enterprise, the governor is asking for one-third of the excess above the 10% to go into what we're calling the Education Opportunity and Innovation Fund. And he would be directing the Joint Board of Education to identify how to strategically invest those dollars so that at the K-12 level, we can do what the speaker had laid out in her plan, which was to support struggling schools, schools that have innovative ideas that can help us move forward and design best practices, and also then to looking at community colleges and our universities to make, again, strategic investments in those programs to whereby we can help students move through the system faster, make sure that we address the economic needs of this state. Two-thirds of the excess would go into the stability fund. We support the proposal that has moved through the legislature to increase the cap from 5 to 10% because it makes sense if we have this 10% guarantee that we need to have a stability fund there that if, in fact, we have another economic downturn, that there are dollars reserved that we can maintain this commitment. And so,
Mr. Schrader, was that SJR 2?
I believe that is correct, Senator.
Okay, and it hasn't moved in the House. Is that correct?
That is my understanding, Senator. The governor supports raising it from the 5% to the 10%, but that doesn't change the way the formula works. The idea is that the money would go into the stability fund. When the stability fund has reached its cap, then those dollars from the general fund that had flowed in there would go into the innovation account so that the dollars stay inside the education enterprise and we can continue that investment. Now, there are also a couple other pieces in the bill that I want to highlight. We include the high-cost disability fund and the small schools fund. Again, those were pieces that were in the speaker's bill, and we agree with her that they need to be in this. And we have an extension of the Portland levy that exists. It was in the speaker's original plan, although it was pulled out. And the modification that the governor agreed to was to allow a two-year extension. And the rationale behind that is it allows the voters of Portland to get to the next general election so that the school district doesn't suffer the loss of the revenue before the voters even have an opportunity to take action. So it would maintain the district's ability to receive those funds for the 2 years until they get to the general election and put forward a local option, allow the voters of Portland to make that decision. And the final piece that I'll highlight as a part of this is in exchange for the guaranteed support to our post-secondary institutions, we are asking that the institutions control their tuition growth to an increase at no greater than the increase in the Oregon median family income. So that, in fact, there's a relationship between the growth of tuition and the ability of Oregon families to pay for that increase in the tuition. If the universities or the community colleges need to exceed that, then we ask that they come and they report why, and they present the need for exceeding that. The governor, and I'll kind of loop back to my beginning comments, the governor believes very strongly that education is the driver that's going to build and expand our economy. That if we believe that we should put Oregonians back to work at family wage jobs, this is a good investment. If we believe that growing the economy will reduce crime and reduce the need for jail beds, that it will help Oregonians support themselves and their families and thus reduce the need for governmental assistance. If expanding the economy will actually give the state the revenue it needs to support the programs that we all believe that we need in this state, then in fact this is the kind of investment that we need to make. And we need to make this commitment so that school districts, community colleges, and the university system can have long-range planning, can actually leverage resources across sectors with each other, not find themselves worried at towards the end of each biennium, oh my gosh, we better hold back some of these dollars because we don't know what's going to happen next and have the rug pulled out from underneath us, but actually allow them to invest in the programs and then actually allow the legislature to spend more time talking about what we're getting for those dollars, the goals that we have for the education system, and less time talking about this floor. And so with that, I'll turn over to Senator Gordley. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gordley, welcome. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the Rules Committee. I want to first thank the Governor and Speaker Menas for elevating the discussion about education funding, and for the record, I'm Avail Gordley, representing Senate District 23, Northeast and Southeast Portland. Again, wanting to thank the Governor and Speaker for elevating the discussion about education funding. Their proposals give us several opportunities. Let me say this. We need to stop talking about how late these proposals are coming to us in the process and instead put the energy into understanding the proposals and into taking action before we leave this session. And, Madam Chair, this hearing is so important, and I thank you very much for scheduling this informational time. at last we are talking about a public policy that will bring us closer to funding a seamless educational system from pre-kindergarten through higher education, what the governor calls the education enterprise. At last, we're talking about plans that will move us away from education funding silos that pit K-12 and pre-K and community colleges and higher education all against one another. At long last, we're talking about dedicating a part of our state revenue system to the education enterprise. Dedicating funds provides schools with information that enables them to plan more efficiently. Our schools have already begun their 2005-06 fiscal year without knowing how much money they will have to work with, just like they did in the last legislative session, and in the session before that, and in the session before that, and in the session before that, and on and on. This legislature should act to ensure that the situation does not arise again in our state, and we have control of that. We have control of that, and with the governor's plan and the speaker's plan as a framework, we are at last moving in that direction. This proposed dedication of funding for education should also elevate the discussion about the need for overall tax reform and restructuring. Our current revenue system has been cobbled together over many decades to meet circumstances that no longer exist, that reflect partisan battles that few can remember, that reflect a world stretching back to the beginning of the 20th century. And that will not meet the needs, the structure that we have will not meet the needs of our state. And we know this. Our revenue system acts like a straitjacket on our schools, on public safety, on our ability to provide health care to those 600,000 Oregonians who do not have health care. Our revenue system is a straitjacket on our future. And so I'm appearing here today to put on the record my support for investing in the education enterprise, to support the framework that two Oregon leaders have given us, our governor and our speaker, to say that I support stability, adequacy, accountability, and equity across our entire educational spectrum. But I also support these same principles across all of our essential budgets. And so that includes human services and public safety. I do want to indicate clearly with regard to the framework that the governor has laid out and that the speaker also laid out in her plan, that the importance of having the support for what we call low-performing schools, that is the support that is needed and in the opportunity that will be created through an education opportunity and education innovation fund. Thank you, Jim, which is sketched out here on the panel before you. We need to have that component in the plan that is adopted, and I'm speaking as though we are going to adopt a plan. I also want to make it very clear that, and say again on the record, that we need a component in the plan that we adopt that permits Portland to retain its property tax formula. I want to point out that it is Portland tax dollars that subsidize education across the rest of the state, and that this is not a new tax in terms of the so-called Portland piece or the Portland tax dollar dollar piece that we want to see included in the plan. It would be an extension of a strategy that is vital to reducing the hemorrhaging that continues to occur in our Portland district. And as we meet here today, our district has lost 300 family wage jobs. And Mr. Sager talked about the governor's commitment to growing the economy and growing family wage jobs and putting people back to work. Well, here we are talking about a district that just lost 300 family wage jobs, and that's just totally unacceptable. So to conclude, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm not willing to leave Salem and this capital until our work is done. Much of the governor's proposal has already passed the Senate. This legislation is far too important to Oregon for us not to act. And so I would say that it's not too late. It is, in fact, time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. Senator Gordley, I know you have a committee at 2. Does anybody have any questions for Senator Gordley?
I do.
Senator Ferriello.
For both, actually, passed.
Can we direct them to Senator Gordley so I can get her out of here?
I can, okay. But I'd like to hear from both.
I will give you, you can have all afternoon to ask questions of Mr. Sager if you wish, Senator.
Oh, you know what? There's an opportunity. I don't think I'll avail myself of Madam Chair, but thanks a bunch. The question, and Senator Gordley, I appreciate the fact that you have complimented both the governor and the speaker on the idea of trying to get some parameters around funding and set up some predictability. But it occurs to me that there's probably not been an honest attempt to put the governor in the speaker's office or the speaker in the governor's office to negotiate on the differences in their plans. And I'd like to know if you've heard of that meeting happening, or Mr. Sager, have you helped facilitate those negotiations between the governor and the speaker?
Mr. Sager is closer to the governor and his schedule and all of that, so I'm deferring to the governor's
wise deferral.
Chair Brown and Senator Ferrioli, yes, in fact, there have been conversations dating back to the first meeting that when the speaker came in and spoke to the governor about her plan. And at that point, the governor indicated very clearly to her that the three areas that he had a difference with her are, number one, that it had to be general fund because of the shared responsibility. He had thought about this, you know, for some time. Number two, that it had to be the entire education enterprise, not just K-12, because that simply prolongs this bifurcated debate and struggle between the sectors. And third, that it had to be a larger growth factor, he felt. Since then, as he's worked out the details of this and come up with the 10%, in fact, the speaker and the governor have spoken at least twice that I know of recently, talking about how, you know, these concepts do align, and that looking to see if, in fact, there's a way to come together on the topic.
And so, Madam Chair, those discussions are ongoing.
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, yes.
I think that's a piece of news that is welcome. It's certainly not been widely known. As a matter of fact, we sort of expected the governor to be here today to make this presentation himself.
May I speak to that?
Please.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gorley, I don't know if I should let you, but I am going to.
You may want to join me in speaking to this. It's my understanding that the governor is meeting with a delegation from, Japan?
Japan.
And that is related to our trade relations and with that great nation. And so that is a meeting that is very important as well. But it also points up the need for a lieutenant governor.
Where she was going.
I'm loving this. I am loving this.
I hope former Senator Lynn is listening.
Do you have any more questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I do.
Okay.
And actually, this may be to either panelist. The plan does set or try to set parameters, and I think those parameters are important. But many folks are still responding to an article, a little article on the front page of the Oregonian last week. And my heart goes out to the two teachers who undoubtedly did not know what the purpose of the article was when they had their photograph taken. They'll be more circumspect in talking to reporters from the Oregonian from this point on. What does this plan do to help deal with increasing accountability in the system? It seems a problem that we just keep dumping money in the top of the funnel, hoping to get the money into the classroom to benefit children, when there seems to be so many ways to off-ramp the dollars into benefits and administrative costs and additional benefits outside the PERS program that are negotiated by local districts and other sort of little eddies in the system that keep depriving children of new textbooks, smaller classroom sizes, and so forth. So other than just dumping money into the top of the funnel, how does this plan increase accountability and get more money to the children?
I'll let Mr. Sager speak first, and then I'll follow up with some comments of my own.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, you touched on several issues, so I try to make some notes here so I could hopefully respond to all of them. First of all, let me address the article that was in the Oregonian. I think that it was inadvertently misleading, because the condition under which those two teachers retired after 30 years plus of commitment to the children of this state were conditions that existed. They didn't create those conditions. This legislature has acted during the last session to reform the PERS system. And by the end of this decade, the people that are retiring out of the PERS system are going to have a far different retirement level than some had during this kind of bubble time. And so I would hate for us to use that as another call to arms as to why we need to reform, when in fact they actually retired prior to the reform taking place. The increasing accountability, I think, is an extremely good question. It's one that the governor has thought a lot about, which is why I commented towards the end of my presentation about the ability of the governor and the legislature to really focus more time on what are we getting for our investment? What do we hope to be the outcomes from this investment? How are the schools, the universities, the community colleges using these resources? And having our time spent more on that kind of conversation, the policies that drive those decisions, as opposed to, is it $5 or is it $7? To the governor, that makes a lot of sense. That's what we should be doing. And then we can be talking about if, in fact, we are using the dollars wisely and we are getting what we can out of that investment, why we need to increase the investment. What is the next step? What is the next plateau that we expect students, schools, our system to reach? And so it really helps us to drive that kind of conversation. As far as the issue around the way local districts and community colleges and universities negotiate their collective bargaining agreements, we have a long time commitment in this state to local control. This plan doesn't try to interfere with that. What this plan tries to do is say, from the state level, the state commitment is going to be clear, it's going to be predictable, and it's going to provide stability so that school districts... We just had an article here not too long ago of school districts that had what appeared to be large ending fund balances. Well, if a school district doesn't know, here we are in July, doesn't know what its revenue is going to be next year, no wonder they can't invest fully and leverage those dollars to help children the most. And what we're trying to do is create an environment where they can make that commitment. They can make that commitment along with their other partners, because they're not competing for the same dollars. And in fact saying, how can we leverage our resources and our abilities again to be focused on students?
Senator Gormley?
I'm going to speak to the question around accountability, Madam Chair, and Senator Farioli. As I have listened to both the governor and the speaker and their use of the word accountability as it relates to education, what's very clear to me is that they're both pretty much saying the same thing: accountability for results, accountability for raising achievement for all students. And also recognizing that we need more of an investment in staff development, meaning better preparation of teachers so that we can, in fact, be more effective, so that educators can, in fact, be more effective in getting better results with all students. So that's how I would address the accountability piece. It's striking to me as I look at the two placards before you that in the one on the left, stability, predictability, and investment in education, we need to add back that word accountability so that we keep that piece in front of us as well, because we are talking about public tax dollars, and citizens, my constituents, want to know that their dollars are getting into the classroom, and that their dollars are making a difference in raising achievement. But with that said, I think we need to confess or just recognize that we have not made enough of an investment in staff development or enough of an investment in better preparation of teachers. We're behind in that regard. And so that's a piece that will require a focus as well.
Thank you. Senator Farioli, I need to Senator Atkinson has another question of Senator Gordley, but I just wanted to ask, while we're talking about accountability, the Senate's passed two measures that will put more administrative dollars directly into the classrooms. One was 639, which was a health insurance pooling bill. The other, which was 766, which is fondly known as the Golden Parachute Bill, specifically targeting administrators' golden parachutes after they leave school districts. Both of those, we believe, will put more money directly into the classrooms for our school children. Where is the governor on those two bills, Mr. Sager?
Chair Brown, clearly the governor supports 639, the insurance pooling. We have worked with others for a couple years now on that concept, and there has been research done across the country. I'm sorry that I have to admit I have not spoken to the governor directly about the golden parachute issue, but we are definitely looking at all aspects of how to make sure that more money is available to the classroom. But I need to qualify it in this manner. If we're making the investment into education and we're getting the results we want, why shouldn't we be paying top dollar? The people that make this system work are the teachers and the administrators that are in the classrooms and in the school buildings. And so I think we have to be very careful. And the governor has tried to make this clear as he's been talking to community groups. This isn't an idea of saying that we can have a top-notch education system for cheap. Children that come up to the schoolhouse door nowadays at the age of five have a lifetime of experiences that most of us in this room have never experienced, with abuse, drugs, alcohol, maybe not even an adult in the home with them. And we give this message that somehow that child can walk into that building and find a teacher and an administrator and support staff that can make all those issues disappear and educate them and prepare them for cheap. And it can't be done. But if we invest in them early, which is why especially the OPK Head Start program is added to the governor's plan. If we can invest in these children early, in fact, over time, the investment pays back 10, 20, 30-fold. We know that. That's why we need to help. And this isn't a matter of trying to put together a cheap education enterprise. This is putting together a quality education enterprise that has clear predictability and stability of funding so that, in fact, those programs can be maintained.
Okay. I got a number of questions for Senator Gordley. Mr. Sager, I'm going to ask you to be quiet for a minute so I can get Senator Gordley out of here. If I'd have known you all wanted to talk to her, we could have had her come on a special hearing. Senator Atkinson.
I will save my questions, but I'll just a quick comment, as always. In a room of partisans and what I think is the reason why the system's broken, you have always, as we've talked privately and now twice before this committee, raised the decorum, so thank you.
Thank you. Well, that was easy. Okay, Senator Shields.
Senator Gordley, you and I had a long history of not only caring about education, but having real concern in the whole arena of human services. And I've heard from some constituents, as I'm sure you probably have, that they're worried when such a great percentage of money is dedicated to education that some human services arenas may suffer. We've all heard the cliche about, you know, if they feed somebody, they're fed for a day. To teach them how to fish, they can feed themselves for a lifetime. You know, how do you think that through in this arena? Jim and I have already begun to talk about it this morning, but I'd just like some of your thoughts on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Shields. I appreciate your question, and that is why I talked in my formal remarks about the other opportunity we have, which is to address the inadequacy of our revenue gathering system. The system as we know it is inadequate. All of the budgets, most of the budgets that we are passing out this session, whether we are talking public safety, and within the public safety arena, you have the Oregon Youth Authority. We don't have enough funding for all of the beds that are required by the Oregon Youth Authority. If you're talking the Oregon State Police, we're cutting troopers, the very troopers that we need to enforce drug trafficking along I-5, and we have a methamphetamine epidemic. The Department of Justice doesn't have enough attorneys to do consumer fraud. And I can go on and on in the public safety arena. I addressed some of what we're seeing on the human services side. We know about the deep cuts in the Oregon health plan. We know that there are 600,000 people in Oregon who don't have health care, many of whom are children. There are other areas of human services that have to do with services to the very vulnerable, the elderly, the mentally ill. There are all these inadequacies, all these holes in the budgets that keep pointing up the fact that we have inadequate budgets because we have an inadequate revenue system. And we have an inadequate revenue system because we're still working with a system that was framed in the 20th century, and we haven't taken the time to fix it. So it is my hope that this discussion that the governor and speaker have pushed us toward will cause us to at last also focus on the fact that our overall tax system doesn't work. And if we determine that we're going to put this investment into education in this way, well, we can't escape also dealing with the hydraulic effect of what that means on the rest of the system, human services, public safety. We will not be able to escape dealing with that fact.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
That really leads to the most difficult question to ask my friend, Senator Gordley. And that is, when you get right down to it, can you support one without the other, or can you support one before the other, or don't they kind of have to move ahead together? You have been very courageous in the past in talking about inadequate funding and inciting the Oregon Constitution about our constitutional requirement to raise adequate funding. You've done that, and yet here we advance this idea without really advancing the other, and I'm wondering if you support one with the idea of the other, or one ahead of the other, or...
Again, appreciating your question very much, we have to start somewhere, and this is our opportunity to start somewhere with a plan or plans that cause us to have the broader discussion. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is we have to talk about all of it. it doesn't make sense in my mind just to talk about a piece of what it's going to take to move Oregon forward, what it's going to take to claim Oregon's future. We do want to invest in the education enterprise. We want the very best educational system we can provide for all of our people. But don't we also want our people to be healthy and have access to health care? Don't we also want our elderly, our vulnerable elderly, to be cared for to the very best of our ability? Don't we want our law enforcement professionals to be supported in a way that affirms that they are in fact professionals, and that we're not setting up situations that place these law enforcement folks in jeopardy? So I'm saying in a long way that we have to, I think we have the opportunity to address the big picture, because we're still here. And it looks like we're going to be here for at least, 2 weeks, 3 weeks into August. The only thing keeping us from addressing, I'm going to say tax reform, restructuring, the only thing stopping us from dealing with that is us. That's the only thing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity. I was invited to sit in on a portion of this, and I was stuck in state and federal affairs on the House side. I did actually have a couple of very specific questions. In the governor's proposal, I believe when he says 61% of general fund, he's using the broad definition of general fund, is he not? It goes beyond.
Senator Devlin, are these for Senator Gordley?
Oh, no, these are actually for.
Now, I'm going to ask you to hold your questions. Are there any more questions for Senator Gordley? Senator Farioli.
Senator Gordley and I are going to the same location, so I believe it is the same time.
I understand, but she's chairing the committee, that committee, and I'm chairing this one, so until then, I'm going to ask you to hold your questions. Senator Farioli.
Yeah, her committee won't start until I get my questions answered.
That's fine.
I'll be back.
I need her out.
You could ask these two senators to take their differences.
Did you have a question for Senator Gordley?
Just a comment.
Okay.
I did not understand the connection between the governor's plan and the need for a new revenue source. So I appreciate Senator Shields and Senator Gordley's comments on that issue. Thank you.
Article 9, Section 2 and
6. Right, and I didn't realize that meant sales tax, but I think that's where this goes.
Possibly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Farrier. Any more questions for Senator Gordley? We'd love to have you back again, Senator Gordley.
Anytime I'm in town.
Okay. Touché. All right. Senator Farrielly, questions for... Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, you need to go. So we're going to let Senator Devlin... You'll have plenty of time. Don't worry. Okay. Senator Devlin, ask away, but make it quick. So you're not late for committee.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley can wait for me if I waited for her.
No, I don't think it works that way. Go.
I'll give very fast answers. Go ahead.
The governor, in his 61%, he refers to 61% of general fund. He's using the broadest definition of general fund, is he not? That is not simply personal income taxes and corporate taxes. When we forecast general fund, there's about $650 million of additional resources that are classified as general fund. Is he including those within his 61%?
Chair Brown, Senator Devlin, yes, he is using the general fund as it is now defined. And so you're right. There are other elements. The two major elements are the personal and corporate income tax.
Okay. Madam Chair, just a little bit of indulgence. I applaud the governor's efforts in terms of looking at this from pre-K through literally 20, actually, if we wanted to classify it. And I do believe there is the issue about adequacy of revenue out there, but I also believe there's an issue in terms of I think there is a finite amount of revenue that the public is willing to pay for services. And to be quite honest, if we wanted to fund everything the way everybody wanted to fund them, I think that goes well beyond that finite level at which the public is willing to pay for services. But looking at some specifics in here, has the governor found any real structural problems One of them that I've seen in the subcommittee on education, and I don't want the people back here to cringe, is community colleges. Community colleges have literally been put into a box, an absolute box. They have no longer any real operating authority to go out and to get operating revenue from the public. They're locked into a millage rate. They're literally, they can go out for general obligation bonds for capital, but in terms of operating, they have no source. And so they're literally dependent upon whatever the state gives them, plus however much they can raise tuition. Has the governor examined any of those real structural problems that some of these entities might have? And I'm sure higher ed could probably point out some to you also.
Chair Brown, Senator Devlin, in fact, you know, the more you dig into this whole system, you've come up with problems throughout the funding formulas, the distribution formulas for community colleges. There are issues around that, the distribution formula for their K-12 system. What the governor was looking at was trying to provide this floor and this predictability. When you talk about community colleges, you're absolutely right. He believes we must end the disinvestment, and we need to begin to invest and invest in such a way that it provides them this predictability. Does not mean that we restore funding to the level that people would like to have the funding restored to and to be able to restore all the programs that the community colleges have had to cut back on, the universities in our K-12 system. But we have to stop the bleeding. And we have to begin to turn this around. That's what this proposal calls for, which is why he's clear that this is a floor, not a ceiling.
Two final questions, Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin, go ahead.
This is just a... People sometimes misunderstand, I believe, the quality education model, because all they look at is whatever figure is published, whether it's 7-1 or 7-2 this biennium in terms of billions of dollars necessary. They don't look at it as a tool. Can you comment on how it's kind of misjudged and how it can be useful as a tool? And can you open the door to saying whether or not we should have a quality education model? Since the speaker comes forward with a stability plan for K through 12 and the governor comes forward with a pre-K through 20, should we have a pre-K through 20 quality education model?
Chair Brown, Senator Devlin, I don't think the governor would disagree with that kind of concept. In fact, he has directed the State Board of Higher Education, along with the State Board of Education, to develop a strategic long-range plan for education in the state. The quality education model is a very useful management tool, a very useful investment tool to look at the kind of return we could get for investment, for instance, that I think we should use more often. The governor and I served together on the first commission, so he's intimately aware of the value of that quality ed model, which is why, in fact, in the proposal before you, we even cite that as being the cap for appropriation for the legislature in K-12, that it can be no more than 100% of the quality education model, because we understand the validity of that model and its usefulness. Expanding that to be pre-K 20, I think, is useful. The direction that the governor has given to the joint boards is looking at even the budgeting system pre-K 20, and we're talking about that, and again, lining that up with the outcomes we expect. So the kind of work that you're talking about is already in progress, but to make it a more formal process, I don't think the governor would be opposed to that.
Thank you.
Anything further, Senator Devlin?
No.
Okay, you can go to your committee.
Please go to your committee.
Let's call up, do you have some more questions for Mr. Sager?
I do, but we can call Mr. Sager later.
Okay.
I have the gap.
Chancellor Pernsteiner, Ms. Prosperali, and Dr. Williams. And I have to apologize. The good news is that we're going back into negotiations. The bad news is I'm going to give the gavel to my colleague here. So, anyway, good luck. Thank you.
I don't see a downside here, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is George Pernsteiner. I'm the acting chancellor of the Oregon University System, and I appreciate the opportunity to be with you this afternoon. I believe that what will define a successful society and economy in the 21st century will be the creativity and flexibility of its people. And all of education, from pre-K through the PhD, or as Senator Devlin said, pre-K through 20, helps instill the ways of thinking that form the framework of that creativity and of that flexibility. And I think the governor's plan recognizes this fundamental fact, that we are looking at an entire enterprise that is necessary for the state. I think it's clear to all of us that Oregon needs educated citizens in a 21st century global information-based economy, and that for Oregonians to be successful, they will need greater levels of education than ever before. So we know that as a state, we must invest in education. The governor's proposal is a good first step. It is not a panacea. It does not solve every ill of this state. But it does stop the slide and the roller coaster ride that we have been on, and provides the predictability that will allow intelligent planning and consistent programming to meet the state's needs. The Senate recently passed a budget for the Oregon University System, as has the House. They are different budgets, but nonetheless they have been passed by the chambers. Those budgets are several million dollars below the essential budget level to continue current programs for current enrollment. And they will represent what may be very nearly the lowest investment of state support per student in the United States this coming biennium. That is the base from which we will start as we move forward. And I wanted to make sure that we all recognize that that's the base from which we begin. We understand that the governor's proposal provides state funding for increased enrollment and for capital construction that will be in addition to the 110%, or the 10% growth amount. Even so, the proposal will not overnight solve the accumulated problems of Oregon's slide to the bottom in funding nationwide. Problems such as low faculty salaries, deferred maintenance, high student-faculty ratios, lack of advisors, and high tuition. But, and this is a very important but, and this is the reason that we are very pleased to be here today, with consistent investment over several years, Oregon will be able to develop and sustain the education system that is needed in the state for the 21st century. Last year, the State Board of Higher Education enunciated four principles to guide its work, the work of the campuses, and the budget that it was bringing to you in this session. And those were access, affordability, excellence, and economic development. The governor's plan can address all four of these areas by providing funds to support students, by keeping tuition affordable for all Oregonians, by permitting investments in programs and faculty, and by allowing targeted investments in key areas that will help drive a successful state economy. The Post-Secondary Academic and Workforce Investment Fund that is contained in the governor's proposal will help permit those targeted investments and the educational improvements that will keep Oregonians competitive in a world economy. But the key to success is predictable, consistent investment at higher levels than we have seen in recent years. The governor's plan is a good start for Oregon's future success, and I believe for the success of the children and grandchildren of us Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Should we go to President Pulliams, please?
Good afternoon, Chair, to the committee, members of the committee. I'm President Williams, District President for Portland Community College, and I'm here today to testify in support of the Governor's Education Investment Plan. There are several components of this plan that are compelling as we review it. First of all, the plan provides a vision for financing and supporting education. It includes a method for the state to begin amassing a rainy day fund and setting aside an account for strategic investment in academic and workforce development programs. This aspect of the plan is very exciting. It gives us access to move in new directions rather than struggling just to simply maintain the status quo. The governance plan recognizes that a strong educational system at all levels is critical to economic stability in this great state. This plan provides a clear path for investing so we can take on new initiatives and save for the next economic downturn. It also provides an element of stability and predictability for state funding K through 20 that we sorely need. The plan ends the practice, for all intents and purposes, of a zero state appropriation every biennium. I have been in Oregon in this job for a year now, and at least 8 months of these last 12 months, the college has been engaged in the budgeting process. We began last December to put together assumptions about state funding levels we could expect from the state and from other sources based upon our original planning on the governor's proposed budget, and then adjusted our budget according to the new information and hints that came from the legislature and various committees throughout the spring. The process included 100 hours of time for our board, staff, faculty, and members of the Citizens Budget Committee. It consumed a great deal of our energy and focus that could have been spent on instructional issues. For that, as we, educational institutions, were also forced to issue layoff notices to loyal and qualified staff and faculty based on our best assumptions regarding the budget. The College Board adopted our college budget last month. But as you know, we still do not have a firm number from the state. The governor's plan would give us at least some solid information from the beginning, a place we can start our planning, a way we can look out beyond the next biennium and predict what might be in store for us. The governor has acknowledged that the guaranteed increase of 10% each biennium for each sector of education is a floor, not a ceiling. It will enable us to come to the legislature and make a case for additional funds if we experience rapid enrollment growth or if the state asks us to take on new programs. The plan also provides the governor and educational leaders with a way to talk to Oregonians about the importance of education in this state and the role education plays in developing a skilled workforce and in energizing the state's economy. While there are some details that certainly need to be worked out, such as the tuition cap discussion or language regarding community colleges, this is a good starting point for building a stronger educational system, for bringing the sectors of education together for the benefit of our students, and for giving us a vision for the future. I applaud the governor for stepping forward with this initiative. Again, thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'll be willing to take questions later. Thank you.
Kim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Cam Corey Sprawley. I am the director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I have shortened my testimony. Much of it is redundant of what you have heard, but let me just say that the future of Oregon's economic and business vitality is inextricably linked to the level of education and skills of our labor force. And Oregon faces some serious challenges, not just in raising the bar for our K-12 system, but in closing the gap between high school and college, and in raising the skills of over 500,000 Oregonians who are in our labor force who do not have a high school diploma. Without increased access and opportunity, these Oregonians will not qualify for the two-thirds of all jobs created in the next decade that will require skills of someone with at least some college. In simple terms, education matters. To respond to the increasing demand for educated and skilled workers, the governor's plan provides real investment for the education enterprise, providing a floor of stability and predictability. And funding over time will offer community colleges and the other elements of the education enterprise the ability to truly plan for the future, to provide programs that meet the needs of students, local employers, and our businesses statewide. I believe that the governor's educational investment plan deserves your serious consideration. Thank you.
Questions for the panel?
Yes, Senator Shields.
I have been thinking a lot about the whole issue of what it looks like if
Oregon is on the bottom in terms of investment per student in college, university educations. And I'm sure you folks travel around the country. You're not just here in Oregon. You must be getting some feedback. What's it like to be in this unenviable position? What are people saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, they have two reactions. The first is, we're glad we're not you. The second really is, what do you do and how do you do it? Because part of, at the same time, that our investment has been reduced, we have managed to maintain enrollment growth. We have managed to maintain a reasonable graduation rate. But we've done it in ways that are not sustainable for the long term, and that's the discussion we wind up having. To give you an example, a very specific one, we have 80,000 students in the Oregon University system today. We had 60,000 10 years ago. We have fewer regular faculty today than we did then.
How do you do that?
Well, we use more adjuncts who are not regular faculty. We use more graduate assistants, and we have larger class sizes. What you lose when you lose regular faculty is the connection with the students for advising, for navigating through to their career plans, for the kinds of things that enrich the student experience, so that even as we are able to mount the classes, we are not able to provide that same level of support to students that we were able to do 10 years ago when we had a larger faculty. These are things that every state grapples with to one extent or another. And so they look to us to what, you know, how have we done it? The other thing that we've done, quite frankly, we've gotten much better at fundraising. But then so have a lot of the others. There are a lot of things that we have done in order to continue to provide as high a quality of service as we can. But as we indicated to Senator Devlin's committee in Ways and Means, there are some warning signs. The one is the reduction in the number of regular faculty, even as enrollment has increased. The second, obviously, is tuition, which has gone up somewhat above national norms. A third is deferred maintenance. We have a $600 million deferred maintenance backlog among our campuses, so that we've basically been eating away at the infrastructure which we have. To give an example of what we do, I mean, Portland State is a very good example. We offer laboratory classes from midnight to 3 a.m. on Sunday mornings, as well as every other day. Why? Because we have so many students and so few labs that we basically are running a seven-day schedule into the wee hours in order to provide the facilities. That's the kind of thing over time that's not sustainable. It's not sustainable because those labs are going to wear out. And if you take them offline, how then do you teach the students, because we don't have enough others? Those are the kinds of issues long term that the erosion of state support in the last 15 years has led to. And it's why I say that it's not sustainable to continue to do what we've been doing. This proposal gets a start to being able to predict and plan for a future that will let us meet the needs of the next 15 years for our guidance.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I also
respond
to that in terms of the funding level and what it means, at least
yes,
in the community college sector? Again, I'm active nationally, and I get a chance to go to other sectors of the region of the country and look at what's going on with community colleges. And there is a direct impact. I mean, community colleges is sort of our mission, make a commitment, and this is a national standard for us to be comprehensive, for us to be affordable, for us to be accessible, to be flexible. To be supportive of students, to start with students no matter where their level is in terms of support, financial aid, counseling, academic advising, et cetera. We also enroll, due to the nature of our mission and our institution, a disproportionate number of minority students and students of color, and often poor families in some cases. What this does for us in terms of impact the lower funding has had on our sector in this state is that we can't be as comprehensive. We find ourselves reducing programs, particularly high-cost programs. For example, in our region around the Portland area, there's a real need for more allied health workers, particularly in nursing. That's a very expensive process for us. We have a great nursing program, but we have to restrict access to that because we cannot afford to expand it. In terms of affordability, we've been forced reluctantly to increase our fees and tuition to help meet our operating costs. That really indirectly denies access of some particularly poor families. Our ability to be supportive, to have enough counselors and these types of support staff available to service students is severely restricted. Our ability to be flexible in terms of planning, for future planning in terms of coming online with new programs makes it more difficult. I'm approached on a daily basis by area businesses in terms of what can you do as a community college president at our community college in our district to create more skilled workers for our businesses and firms. It is very difficult under these circumstances.
Senator Ringo?
Well, I just want to thank you for coming here and Preston, I remember greeting you in about your first or second week at PCC, and you had a lot of guts coming to Oregon, given our structure. What you mentioned about training healthcare workers, I've heard that a number of times from constituents who have wanted to retrain into the healthcare field. And so we've got people who really want to work, and we have employers out there who really want trained employees. And the people who aren't working aren't making money, so they're not contributing tax dollars to our state coffers. And community colleges should be the glue to put that together. And by not investing in community colleges, we're missing out all the way around. So I just thank you for coming today, and I hope 5 years from now we have a better picture.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rangel, it wasn't that difficult to leave New York to come to the great state of Oregon. And I've had a great time my first year because, again, it's a great state. Portland is a great area as far as quality of life. The big challenge in terms of how can we make Portland Community College a quality district. I have a lot of support out there to do that. So I'm enjoying my job. I'm enjoying being here. But this is a challenge that we simply have to address.
Exactly right. Thank you.
Panel, I have questions. The testimony and the observations of my colleagues, particularly Senator Devlin, Senator Shields, when he indicated concern about the social services, and Senator Gordley, who also indicated that she was concerned about those services, each of your institutions is uniquely responsible for direct services to citizens of Oregon who will, in turn, accede to the roles that serve others. The chancellor certainly is responsible for helping to maintain access to education at all the higher levels of education. Portland State University has a unique role. Portland Community College has a unique role in developing nursing programs, social sciences, social services, human services, medical technology, medical services training, and certainly the services that are provided in educating workforce are directly related to delivery of those services. One of the key differences between the speaker's plan, which dedicates personal income tax, and the governor's plan, which dedicates a larger percentage of the general fund, is the effect that it will have, the effect of those two different plans on the other services. When you dedicate a portion of the general fund, you certainly do compete directly with the other general fund agencies in the state of Oregon. And there would be a direct negative effect on social services, health services, human services, and public safety. There's just no question about the fact that you will, if you dedicate more of the general fund dollars, you simply will take those general fund dollars offline for other social and human services.
how will you respond in the community when the folks that you're educating and the missions that you have can't be met with general fund money because of the relative dedication to education? We'll be educating people, to serving communities where the dollars will not be available from the general fund to pay for those services. How do we as legislators, what's your advice to us to balance those issues? Because that's the trade-off that you're asking us to make with the governor's proposal.
Mr. Chair, it is a difficult trade-off, I understand. I think Mr. Sager indicated part of the philosophy that the governor was using in making the proposal is that an investment in education over time should mean, could mean, and probably will mean a lower demand for some of the other services than otherwise would be the case. The hope would be that if we have a more educated citizenry, that in fact we will be able to have a more robust economy. And that is, I think, part of the premise on which the proposal is made.
Mr. Chair, I'll just again response. Again, I certainly support those comments shared with you about enhanced or feel exactly the same way. I know all three of us at the table understand that you're in a difficult position. I'm glad you're sitting there in some ways to make these choices versus I. But I'm certainly here to lobby for a quality education, because I firmly believe that a quality education is the foundation of this whole society, our economy, and what we stand for. And it all starts there. If we can find a way to actually support our activities, I also believe we will reduce the need and priorities for some of those other services. But again, I don't want to sit here and say, give us this money and ignore others. But I am here to say that if we continue down the road we're going, we're going to lose access. A lot of great potential talent will be lost to the state, and it will eventually affect the economy negatively, and that hurts everybody.
Mr. Chair, I think Preston said it very well.
So I'm going to start on the other end. You guys are ripping her off.
I can be redundant, but I don't want to.
Well, I understand you're in an awkward position as well, because I think you are ending up as the poster children for additional revenue for the state. The idea is that if we make this commitment to you, we certainly make it, at least from the legislative standpoint, knowledgeably that we will, in fact, decimate our ability to provide social services, public safety, and other services without new revenue sources. It's just not possible to make a 61% commitment with a 10% guarantee of increase on the general fund revenue and assume that we will grow the economy quickly enough to have any sort of parity in the existing level of social services or human services, health services, or public safety. It's a situation where we have been told repeatedly that the Oregonians are not in a mood for new revenue. I think Senator Devlin explicitly explored the issue in his testimony as a guest panelist, in that there's a place, a finite level at which Oregonians simply will not go. And I just wonder if the legislature is not being sort of put in a situation where our dedication to children in the future ends up simply being an end game for a revenue package that goes out and may be defeated. So, again, I think we're in a situation where we are writing checks we can't cash later. Your dedication to education and the future of Oregonians is not questioned here. And I thank you very much for the testimony and your willingness to come down and add your professional integrity and your zeal and your dedication to the call for some system of certainty. Senator Atkinson showed great restraint in not pounding the table and demanding the 81st day legislation, which I think we have pending somewhere. But thank you very much for your
time. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have had a couple of additions to the list for
witnesses. We have nine more. We'll have two more panels at 3. I would like to have Molly Adams, Tricia Smith, and Marcia Kelly, please, forward. And on deck will be Andy, Jordan, Lori Wimmer Whelan, and Catherine Firestone. Welcome.
Thank you.
Begin on this side.
All right.
This way.
My texture says Madam Chairman, but I'll change that. Mr. Chairman and committee member, thank you for the opportunity to make comments for Stand for Children on the Governor's Education Plan. My name is Molly Adams, and I'm the parent of an eighth grader in the Canby School District, and I am an active participant in my child's education. Stand for Children appreciates the Governor's attention to what he's calling the education enterprise. We agree with him that strong investment in preschool through high school education is the surest way to improve outcomes for today's children, along with improving the well-being of our communities and the health of our economy. Last week, we appeared before you to express concerns about the spending cap that Speaker Menas proposed for K-12 public schools. The governor's plan is a significant improvement on that proposal, proposing a floor but not a ceiling for public school investment. Unfortunately, the governor's plan leaves us unclear about how we will restore our schools to the reasonable class sizes and full educational programs that used to be a source of pride in our state. Like the Menas plan, the governor's plan provides about $5.8 billion for K-12 in the 2007-09 budget. This sounds like a lot of money, but it's no more than required to simply maintain current inadequate service levels. It falls $500 million short of the $6.3 billion needed to fund K-12 at the 2001 level before the recession forced deep cuts to schools around the state. Do we want elementary classes to continue to be the second largest in the nation? Do we want days of instruction for our students to be among the fewest? A generation, my child's generation, is being raised without access to physical education, foreign language instruction, and opportunities that their peers have in other states that we compete with. We urge the legislature to commit itself to examining the merits of this plan during the interim, answering the question not just of stability, but of adequacy. In the meantime, there are several important components of the governor's plan that we hope the legislature will address. We appreciate the fact that the Senate has already passed a number of stability, cost efficiency, and accountability bills that are awaiting action in the House, including the statewide health insurance pool. We encourage you to find a way to enable Portland to continue its local tax collections to offset the revenues they are losing. As a parent in Canby, I want to see solutions that benefit all students in every community. But if there are local dollars available in Portland that do not disadvantage anyone else, it would be wrong not to clear the way. We urge you to forge an agreement with your colleagues in the House to fund schools now at the current service levels. Then work during the interim to develop a plan that raises the floor levels that support our students and our economy to be among the best in the nation. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, public employee union, representing about 20,000 education professionals working in a wide variety of educational settings, including Oregon's Head Start agencies, K-12 school districts, ESDs, and community colleges. I'm happy to come to you today to speak about the governor's plan and to tell you the things that we appreciate about his effort and the things that we still have concerns about. First of all, we're very happy that the governor and, for that matter, the speaker and many members of this body recognize the importance of education and education funding in the well-being of our state and our economy. We have long been telling you that those pieces of our budget are critical to our future success, and we are glad that we have additional voices in that effort. We agree that economic development depends on a healthy education system at all levels, and you cannot fund one without the others and still have a healthy economy. We appreciate that the governor has expanded beyond the speaker's proposal in his proposal to include a larger variety of funds, that he has expanded the proposal to include all levels of education, and that he has raised the growth factors within the bills. We also appreciate that this proposal includes the high-cost disabilities grant and the small schools grant that have been lost in the shuffle of these kinds of discussions. And we hope that those proposals do go forward in this legislative assembly to improve our education funding formula. However, I'm here also to speak to you today about OSEA's concerns with the speaker's plans. Plan, which are very similar to the concerns that we offered you last week regarding the governor, the House Bill 2450. Did I say that wrong? The governor's plan this time, speaker's plan last time. Sorry, a lot of plans. While the governor's plans expand the education universe to include all of education, like House Bill 2450, it attempts to require future legislatures to appropriate a predetermined percentage of future revenues to the pre-K through 20 education system. We understand the bill's purpose is to try to take the political discussion out of your appropriation to education and provide school districts with what some have said would be some certainty into future biennia as to how much funding they can expect from the state. We're concerned that, first of all, that's a false promise. What you're promising is a percentage of projected revenue. And for those of you that have been here a few years, you know that those projections sometimes change dramatically, and with them, the percentages that you may allocate. So what you're promising is a percentage, not an actual funding amount. And so that's no more predictable far into the future than what you're doing right now. We understand, though, that you might be tempted to try to do that, to try to take the difficult decision of how much money to provide education in each biennia out of this process. And if you do that, though, the accountability to the public would go with that decision. We can understand you might think it might be easier for legislatures in the future if they don't have to worry about that, if they only have to worry about how schools spend the money. I heard someone say earlier that that way you'd have time to discuss how schools spend the money. I suggest that this House has spent a great deal of time talking about how schools spend money, and you have provided some very good proposals to improve that process. Legislative ease doesn't translate to adequate education for our children, and that's the responsibility that we don't believe that the public will allow you to set aside with a proposal like this one. In addition to that, the Constitution doesn't allow you to set a percentage of available revenue as your amount to fund education. Constitution in Section 8, in Article 8, Section 8, requires, as it says, the Legislative Assembly shall appropriate in each biennium a sum of money sufficient to ensure the state's system of public education meets quality goals established by law. There's nothing in this proposal that meets that constitutional requirement. The governor's plan, like House Bill 2450, seems to us to be in clear conflict with that language. Although the governor's plan has a different percentage and limits than those proposed in House Bill 2450, the conflict with the Constitution still remains. Another problem with the governor's plan that has been mentioned by Senators Shields and Ferrioli already is that it ignores other aspects of the budget that have a direct impact on student learning and achievement. OSEA members work every day with children who are dependent on the services provided by the human resources budget and the public safety budget. OSEA members understand that it's very difficult to educate a hungry child or an abused child. To make arbitrary decisions today about what will be needed in the future does not allow future legislatures to look at the current circumstances the state faces when they are sitting in your chairs and make decisions based on what's right for the state at that time. Another concern we have is that the legislature, according to our understanding of the Constitution, does not have the authority to bind through statutes future legislatures' actions. This proposal is a statutory proposal. I suggest to you that passing it would be a futile attempt to bind a future legislature to a course of action that it can ignore. And finally, we believe the reason that it's difficult for the legislature to appropriate an adequate or sufficient amount of money to schools is the same reason that you can't support public safety budgets or human resources budgets to the extent that you believe they are adequate. As Senator Gordley suggested, we have a broken revenue system. There is nothing in this plan that will solve that problem. As I pointed out to you last week and reminded you, Senator Gordley likes to remind you and beat me to it, that Article 9, Section 2 states that you have the requirement, the obligation, to raise revenue when the revenue is not sufficient to meet the needs of the state as you have determined them. The governor's plan does nothing to help meet your constitutional requirements, and it only changes the percentages within the within the House Bill 2450. We hope that rather than passing a plan like this, which offers too many questions and too few solutions, that instead you pass budgets for the next biennia, put forward these discussions for the interim when we can have a longer discussion about them, and move forward to get your House compatriots to pass some of the things that you've passed across to them to improve our education system. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Kelly?
Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the American Association of University Women of Oregon, with over 2,000 members in the state. Many of them are teachers, retired teachers, although we have great diversity in the occupations of our college-educated members. We're here like we were 9 days ago, cautioning the use of a fixed amount in any budget until you take the real step that is needed in this state, and that's tax reform. Not necessarily a new tax system, but maybe tax reform. Next year, according to my calculations, the corporate minimum tax will celebrate its 75th or diamond anniversary, it being at $10. And that went down because of the Depression. It had been at 25 the prior biennium. We think that that's a piece that could be looked at. Businesses in this state, since 1970, have, as a share of funding the state, decreased 70%. When Mr. Sager was talking about the governor meeting with businesses and having the fact that the businesses didn't talk about our tax structure or have a concern about it, I can probably tell you why. And all of these stats are in my written testimony from 9 days ago. In business taxes per dollar of private sector economic activity, Oregon is at 3.4%, the U.S. average is 4.8, and we rank 50. Business taxes per dollar of capital income, we're at 8.7 in the U.S. The average is 15.6, and again, Oregon's rank is 50. Business taxes per employee, Oregon ranks 49. And in business share of all state and local taxes, Oregon ranks 48. This comes from the cost study, which is done by the Council on State Taxation, which was originally an advisory group to the Chambers of Commerce of the United States, or Council of State Chambers of Commerce, excuse me, and has a membership of 550 major corporations. We contend that we are not going to get anywhere on funding human resources, public safety, or the all-important education until we look at the way we are funding our state. And I agree with you, Chair Ferrioli. Oregonians are concerned about the tax burden that they have on their shoulders, because it's increasingly on the shoulders of the middle income and the low income Oregonians, and it's not a justified share with the businesses. Since 1980, 40 of the 48 business tax breaks have gone on the books. And in that same time, Oregonians voted to limit their property tax and thereby change the way that we fund education since 1990. We started feeling the full effect in 1995. We have done nothing as a state, and the legislature has done nothing as a legislature to address this drastic shift in how we fund Oregon. It has now been 10 years since ballot measure 5 was fully implemented with a cap of $5 for education and $10 for public service, other general governments, and nothing has been done to change that shift from local entities to the state funding things, and we think it's overdue. So we will not support any provisions for funding education at a percentage amount until the legislature does its job and does tax reform. Thank you for this opportunity to give my little homily.
Thank you. I would just instruct the staff to bring forward the written testimony from 9 days ago and make it part of the record on this proposal as well. Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I just wanted to ask Ms. Kelly again, that those the tax statistics you referenced are from where?
It's the Council on State Taxation. The figures are for 2003. I could probably provide you with the website to find it, but it's the Council on State Taxation, and they do this report. And the membership is not liberal think tankers. It's 550 major corporations that fund this study.
Thank you.
Ms. Kelly, is that... are those statistics referenced in your written testimony?
They are referenced in my written testimony, but I will be happy to find the website where you can download the entire report.
Thank you, and we'll have that redistributed to members. Any further questions for the panel? Senator Smith?
Both of you, one way or another, Colleen Smith, referred to sufficient funds. I mean, the Constitution says you have to come up with sufficient funds. It would seem that our definition of sufficient is insufficient in Oregon. I mean, if we are 48th, 49th, 50th, how do we how can we even begin to think we're sufficient? I mean, I know that's a rhetorical question, but I'm hearing what you're saying. Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chair, please let me respond. Senator Shields, it is a rhetorical question, and I would suggest that you don't suggest you're sufficient. When I listen to the floor speeches about budgets, whether they are on the House side or the Senate side, what we hear repeatedly, regardless of the budget, is that they are insufficient. Mm-hmm. The Oregon legislature and the governor issue a report every 2 years, as required by the Constitution, to outline whether or not your education allocation is sufficient. And every single report since that requirement came into the Constitution clearly states that it is insufficient. So you don't exactly say that these are sufficient, that our system is sufficient. You wring your hands and say it's insufficient and wish you could do something about it. We think you can. And we encourage you to go forward.
Thank you, panel. We have three more. I believe it's the last three. Andy Jordan, Laurie Wimmer Whelan, Catherine Firestone. Laurie, would you care to start, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Laurie Wimmer Whelan, representing the Oregon Education Association, its 45,000 members, representing both K-12 and community college. And you are about to receive written testimony that misperceived the bill number as House Bill 2070 with a set of amendments. My apologies. I will henceforth refer verbally to House Bill 3739, which I think is what is before you. I'd like to begin by thanking the governor for his leadership and advocacy for public education. We are impressed by the convincing case he has made for investing in a vibrant educational system as a way to stimulate a healthy economic development in Oregon. We couldn't agree more with his view. We've done a number of studies with the help of Eco Northwest in past years, especially as Oregon slid towards recession, and we have shared with many of you the results of those studies that make a clear and convincing case for the same point, and also underscore the fact that when schools are underinvested in, the communities in which they are located also suffer. The bill before you today represents a significant improvement on ideas that were first presented by the speaker, as you've heard today, in her education stability plan, which we also appreciated as an important beginning of this conversation regarding education funding. Our concerns with that first proposal were several. As we shared with you before, we opposed reliance on the personal income tax as the sole source of education funding, as well as we opposed setting a ceiling or a cap on the K-12 budget, particularly one that offered such a low level of funding. We opposed using current funds to speed up the capitalization of the Education Stability Fund. We oppose delinking, psychologically or literally, the budget growth to legitimate education cost drivers and mandates, both at the state and federal level. We oppose trading off stability for adequacy. We question the purpose and level of funding for the Successful Schools Fund as it was originally construed, especially given the proposed low state school fund level in that plan. And we worried about immortalizing $800 million worth of cuts that K-12 has sustained in the previous 4 years while we've been in and climbing out of our economic recession, as well as the predictable further ratcheting effect that a static growth factor would impose on school budgets in the event of high inflationary years in the out years. We noted also that only the K-12 education stratum was addressed by that version of the concept and not, as this bill will have, the entire education enterprise. So as you can see, many of the issues that we identified with the previous plan had been addressed in the governor's proposal. We support, for instance, the tie to the entire general fund rather than solely the personal income tax for education funding. We believe that our concerns about capping the budget have been addressed by expressing the dedicated amount to school as a range that tops out at the quality education model funding level for the K-12 portion. And the growth rate from biennium to biennium has also been slightly improved, though its basis remains the same as that in the speaker plan, that is the 5.318 level. The governor's proposal addresses the entire education spectrum, which is also acknowledged and appreciated. And finally, 3739 would repurpose the Successful Schools Fund by creating a more general investment fund whose disbursements would be decided cooperatively by the Joint Boards of Education and would have a broader purpose than solely funding NCLB, because it would also fund innovation, not just helping schools with struggling students. There are other ideas expressed by the governor's vision that we support as well, including his call for educational economies and efficiencies, such as the ESD reform and health insurance pooling for the education community. We also support his efforts to limit tuition increases to an affordability index, as measured by the Oregon median family income, thereby ensuring access by more Oregonians to post-secondary education. This plan represents a thoughtful contribution to this ongoing conversations Oregonians have been having. As such, it's a good start. We at the Oregon Education Association remain committed, as we've said, to various committees this session, to a three-step approach to climb out of our education funding hole. First, we ask that biennial budgets maintain at least the status quo, that students not be asked to take even more cuts than they've recently sustained. Secondly, we're looking for a plan that builds back the many programs and services that have been lost over the past 4 years, such as in the K-12 environment, music, art, PE, counseling, TAG, foreign languages, library services, school nurses, tutorials, and the like, and the many courses that have been closed or limited at our community colleges. Third, we dream of the day that Oregon may finally solve its funding adequacy conundrum, as so many of you have addressed today, so that we can fully fund the ambitions of its students, teachers, and other education employees, whether that be to fully fund community college enrollment growth or to fund K-12 at the QEM full funding level or to offer Oregon Pre-K and Head Start to all eligible preschoolers in the state. In the meanwhile, the Oregon Education Association does not support setting the controls on autopilot, nor on robbing other vital programs resources in order to fully fund education. The unvarnished truth is that we do not, at this time, have the resources to allocate a sufficient budget to all worthy and competing needs in this state, and no formula will solve that problem. As this legislature and the governor move forward with this most important conversation, it is the hope of the OEA that this goal of funding adequacy will not take a back seat to funding stability. Thank you.
Ma'am.
Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee, my name is Andy Jordan. I'm the Vice President for Legislation for the Oregon PTA. I'm a volunteer lobbyist representing 23,000 members statewide. We simply advocate for kids. Oregon PTA continuously identifies school funding as the number one priority facing children in education in this state. School funding for our 23,000 members is defined as not only stable, but adequate to support the well-being and education of every child. Oregon PTA believes in academics, including foreign language, art, music, and PE. Oregon PTA also believes in the whole child and the well-being of every child. Oregon PTA would also like to thank the governor for expanding on the speaker's plan, whereas we do not believe in spending a cap on education, we believe in establishing a floor. While we applaud the notion of tackling stability, Oregon PTA does not support this in isolation. We do not support this in the absence of adequacy. This plan would allow status quo to continue, large class sizes, lack of art, music, and PE, and one of the shortest school years in the country. PTA believes in the goal of stability is good, but mediocre schools are still mediocre if they are stable. Oregon PTA also believes that this notion of deciding money before programs is backwards. First degree how to serve our children and how to invest in programs. Deciding on dollars before programs doesn't make sense. In 2000, Oregon PTA sat on the Quality Education Commission, and the person sitting on that commission is sitting right next to me now. So Oregon PTA is very aware of what the model was intended for. How much of the QEM are we willing to pay for, and how much are we willing to make? And we haven't even broached the subject of adding back the dollars lost in K-12 funding in recent years. An education funding plan should never be about stopping parents and education advocates from entering the building. No Child Left Behind mandates parents' rights as a partner and decision maker. Advocacy and collaboration of parents is key to student success. Parents continue to be left out of any serious discussions. Oregon PTA is here to ask for movement on this year's biennium, and in the meantime, we look forward to working on a plan and expanding on the idea of stability. Oregonians and PTA members want excellent schools and an investment in Oregon. Our responsibility is to deal with both adequacy and stability. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee. I'm Catherine Firestone, Executive Director of the Coalition for Schools. I'm going to make this very brief. We are very pleased to have the governor enter this discussion, and we certainly appreciate his expansion both from K-12 to a model that looks at pre-kindergarten to higher ed. It's a direction that the coalition is moving, and we feel very strongly it's a conversation that we need to have. We are also pleased to see the expansion of revenue source using the general fund rather than just the personal income tax. That said, though, we have some other concerns about a plan such as this, many of which I expressed in my testimony the other day as well. We, as an organization, support the work of the quality education model. We have grave concerns about enacting a stability plan based on a number that is inadequate for this biennium, that was based on a number that was inadequate last biennium. We also are concerned about the concept of governing by percentage, whether it's K-12, it's pre-K to higher ed, or it's health and human services. As Andy said before me, we believe that we need to talk about services, what it is that we are required to provide for Oregonians, and then assess the cost of that and how we will pay for it. And we believe this to be not the way that we should be doing business in the state. Again, the coalition is committed to working on this, to finding the long-term solutions. We would welcome the opportunity to participate on any plan as we proceed into the interim. And again, we would urge you to move forward on a budget for this, our schools for this year. Thank you.
Colleagues, questions?
Thank you.
Just to characterize, I don't want to mischaracterize this, I wondered why, in fact, the sign-up sheet showed that you were neither for, against, nor neutral on this issue. The testimony's made that abundantly clear. And if I just can characterize, the question is sufficiency, adequacy, not necessarily stability. Is that what I'm hearing? You all three testified about the issue of adequacy.
Absolutely, from the coalition standpoint, yeah. Yes.
So this, I think that's a concern that the committee's heard. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I would add that that's the reason I didn't have questions. I asked the earlier question of what happens in the bigger universe, but I think they addressed that in their own way.
Appreciate that. Ms. Jordan, did you have written testimony that you could submit to the committee?
I don't have it with me, but I can send it.
Well, I was noticing that you were reading from testimony.
Oh, I had submitted testimony 9 days ago, and I only brought just my draft that I was reading from. If you would like me to, I can submit that.
And was that your testimony from 9 days ago? Because we can bring it forward and add it to this.
No, one. Not completely, but...
Okay. If you would submit the testimony, I think other members that are not here present to hear personally would value reading your testimony. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, should we bring back our original presenter?
Bring back the original victim, green presenter.
Yeah. Sort of an organic first and last word.
Thank you, Chair Ferriero.
I think you got great feedback from people here about the issue of adequacy. But it was very clear that people have concerned about the hydraulic effect on social services. How does the governor intend to deal with the dedication of 61% of the general fund and the effect on social services, human services, and public safety? What's the plan here?
Chair Ferriero, I appreciate that question because I think it's important to put that 61% into perspective. And let me give you two statistics to think about, and then I'll kind of address it from a different approach. From our best guess of where the budgets will end up at the end of this legislative session, we've tried to calculate what the total would be for the education enterprise, and it works out to be about 60.4%. So 60.4% and 61%, pretty close. If you look historically at the enterprise, and so we've gone back and we've reworked the budgets to look at it historically, it has ranged from 55 to 65%. So again, 61 is not an outlandish number, but it, for the first time, provides a floor, a stable funding level to this enterprise. And so that's the significant difference. Now, to address it from the other perspective, I'm an elementary teacher, so you know I can do the math on this one. The 39% that is left is all that you as the legislature and the governor has to provide all the other services in state government. There's no denying that. But in fact, again, we have to go back to the fundamental assumption here that we need to grow our economy and put Oregonians back to work. That reduces the demand for jail beds and for the social support systems that the government provides by allowing people to support themselves. We think that's the right direction. The governor believes that's the only way we're going to be able to work through this. His plan does not attempt to address the issue of adequacy in funding. You've heard from Senator Gordley and others the discussion about tax reform, tax equity. Those issues are still on the table, and it does not try to provide adequacy in the way that it is defined either for education or any of the other sectors of the budget. It is to establish a floor so we stop the disinvestment in the education system. So in fact, we can drive the economy, increase the revenue for the state, and thus be able to provide those services that we know we need for the rest of our citizens in the state.
Questions?
We talked earlier about this dynamic, and I keep thinking of the bridge between now and this ideal and the number of people that make it push off the bridge in terms of human service. I mean, if you could snap your finger and tomorrow everything was up and running, lots of people would be getting the education that they need and wouldn't end up in the safety nets that are there. It's going to take a long time to build that structure. And so I'm concerned about the bridge from here to there.
Chair Ferriero, may I address that?
If you wish.
Thank you. And Senator Shields, again, we did begin our conversation this morning on this, and I appreciate that conversation. That is another reason why it is so important that we look at the education enterprise. Because while we are building the pipeline from K-12 through, or from preschool to K-12 and into the system, we need to immediately infuse resources into our community colleges and our university system. That is where we get the quick turnaround time. That is where we are able to retrain incumbent workers to help our businesses remain competitive and compete in the global economy that we have. The governor has visited several countries during his tenure in Asia and Europe. Those countries see the value of education. They are making huge investments in education. That is what is giving them the competitive edge. We can't impact the entire country, but the state of Oregon can make a commitment to education to make sure that our workforce is the best we can possibly provide, and thus provide an attraction for businesses to expand and to move here to Oregon, and thus support Oregonians and our way of life.
Mr. Sager, do we have a mechanism for characterizing the educational attainment of those Asian and European countries with which we will compete in comparison with those educational attainments of Oregonians? In other words, we have benchmarks that we've developed in sort of in a vacuum. We compare our test scores nationally, but we're not competing nationally or even regionally. It's international competition. And I've encountered some exchange students who at the age of 15 or 16 years old are speaking fluently 5 and 6 languages, compete with their instructors on a regular basis, or for whom in the classroom has the greater body of knowledge, the teacher or the student. In other words, their goal is to surpass their teachers. And I wonder whether or not we are not deluding ourselves with the benchmarks that we've selected or our testing that's normed against other American students. Do we test against the national and international norms?
Chair Ferriero, we actually had our standards reviewed by ACHIEVE, a national organization that compared them to international standards. And in fact, they did align quite well. Now, we also have to put a broader perspective on this question, because if we match Oregon or U.S. top-performing students with international standards, our students are doing very well. We have a commitment in this country, unlike most nations of the world, where, in fact, every child that walks up to our schoolhouse door, we try to educate, and we want to help them reach their full potential. So we have a standard in this country that says it's not just the best and the brightest at an early age who demonstrate this ability that we help and we leave the others behind. We actually are committed to help all children reach their full potential. So that is a huge financial commitment and a wonderful commitment that makes this nation, I think, the powerful nation it is. So we have to balance how we compare these outcomes. What we need to do, and what Oregon is known nationally for doing, is looking at what we call the continuous growth model. That is, we need to look at where students are starting and make sure that they, as I indicate, reach their full potential, as opposed to simply peeling off the cream of the crop. I had the opportunity to spend some time in Croatia a couple years ago, and they love the United States. They have tried to emulate a lot of the programs that we have in this country, and I had an opportunity to visit their education system. What was striking to me is while the students in the high schools that I visited were doing very well, very bright, very dedicated students, far, far too many of them were sharing with me that they were in the economics high school program and they had been put in that track back in sixth grade, and their parents and the country had committed a lot of resources for them to go through that system, and here they were now equivalent to our junior or senior in high school, and they were absolutely burned out, bored silly. That was not the career that they wanted to pursue. But it makes sense if you're looking at it from the standpoint of getting, you know, targeting their money and moving kind of the cog through the system. What we have done in this country and what the governor would like to see really expand here in Oregon is to use our K-12 system to prepare our students that as they exit high school, they are prepared to enter post-secondary, the workforce, and be good citizens in a way that they have the skills necessary to follow the path that they want. As he has indicated several times, when a student leaves 12th grade, they need the same skills to become an electrician as to go to Portland State to become an electrical engineer. And they need to have those opportunities. That's what this country provides for our students, and that's what our education system in Oregon wants to provide, and that's why it is so important that we dedicate resources so that this system can begin to build and to become the powerhouse, the economic driver, that the governor sees it, and I believe Oregonians see it.
Mr. Sager, there, the way you achieved the 51 is you took a five-year or a three- or four biennium average between 59 and 64. That's how you got to 61%.
Chair Ferrioli, no, that is not how we got to
61. How did you arrive at 61?
We got to 61% by looking at, again, the levels that we felt funding were going to end up at this coming biennium. We agreed with the speaker when she says that the beginning point for K-12 next biennium should be 5318. Seems like if it's a good beginning point, it's a good ending point for the discussions here. So that is the calculation point. And then we added the 10% guarantee to it. That got us up close to the 61%, and we needed to have money to begin to put into that investment account and the stability account. And so we built up to the number rather than just picking some arbitrary number and trying to make the statistics fit.
Okay, so it's your contention that you need no new revenue to accomplish this objective?
It is our contention that, in fact, by setting this as a floor, it is going to provide predictability and stability. We would need
referring to the revenue side of this equation.
On the revenue side, again, based on the projections that the economists provide us, we believe that the revenue will be there. But it's also why we have the stability fund being created, so that if we have an economic downturn, we have the money dedicated to make sure that we can support it and not go through the roller coaster ride like we've put schools through the past several years.
You heard a lot of folks testify on the question of adequacy. That the fact is, they believe that this issue deals more with stability and less with adequacy. Would you characterize how you feel about that? Is that, do you believe that this is going to deal with adequacy and stability, or does this particularly focus on stability?
Chair Ferrioli, the governor sees this as dealing with stability and beginning the reinvestment into the system. We cannot overnight pull together the revenues that are needed to address adequacy. We've had that conversation here today. But the fact is, we can no longer continue to simply water down the soup in the system and every biennium have this fight and try to struggle back to some base number and not allow our system to invest long term in the process, in the educational process. This will create that floor, that predictability, so that they can do that long-term planning, so we can commit to students, we can commit to education, and then come forward to the legislature and talk about what additional outcomes do we want? What additional resources can we and should we dedicate on top of this in order to reach the next plateau of expectation for our students throughout the entire system, but not have the fight constantly be, how do we get back to zero?
Senator Shields, any final questions?
Oh, I have lots of questions, but I'm not going
to
ask them this afternoon. I do appreciate stimulating discussion. I'm still concerned about the bridges that I've been talking about, and I'm concerned, and you heard Senator Gourley and I have the conversation about adequacy.
I see none of the other panelists have questions.
I see none of the other panelists, period.
Thank you, Chair Ferriero.
And in that regard, the Vice Chair has tried to offer an opportunity for the fairest possible hearing for the Governor's plan, and we are in adjournment.